broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month's speaker is Patrick Michael Byrne. The Fort Wayne-born Byrne founded the enormously successful internet company Overstock.com in 1999. He has a master's degree from Cambridge University as a Marshall Scholar and a PhD in philosophy from Stanford University. Byrne is also interested in promoting education. He supports implementing school vouchers and other educational reforms. Byrne spoke to the club about those issues.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Economic Club of Indiana and Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Eli Lilly, it's a great and other sponsors and supporting members, it's really a great honor, surprising honor, to be invited to speak with you today. I love taking questions, and I'm usually find these days that wherever I go, there's no shortage of people who want to ask me questions about different things I've been involved with. But I've been told I have to sing for my lunch here today. So I am going to give you a presentation. Now, this violates, normally, one wouldn't show somebody after lunch, especially some nice, good, tasty carbohydrates, which tend to make folks sometimes a little sleepy. You wouldn't show them a presentation with a lot of numbers in them. I am Warren Buffett, you know, that's a good principle to follow. Warren Buffett likes to say that sometimes a man has to rise above his principles. I'm going to rise above my principles a bit and show you a presentation with some numbers in them. I hope not to put you to sleep. I promise you if you pay attention, well, first of all, it is the Economic Club of Indiana, so none of this should be, and there's really no math. There's a lot of numbers. It's all arithmetic, and there's no arithmetic past about fifth or sixth grade, except the numbers are very big, because I'm going to be talking about government spending. I'm going to start just with asking this question. Now, I'm sure a lot of this, or all of this, is going to be very basic for members of the Economic Club of Indiana, but I'm just going to start off with a little bit on what's wrong with monopolies. Just reminding you, if you've forgotten your college days, why it is we don't like monopolies. Well, let's start with price and quantity. Everybody recognizes supply and demand curves. And in a market, in a a normal basic market, you get a market clearing price, and at that price, the supply and demand balance. And as a result, this is how much stuff society gets. And doesn't matter what good we're talking about. There's a market for some good, and this is how much stuff society gets. It's that much in price and this much in quantity, and you multiply the two together, and that's how much stuff society gets. Well, a monopolist comes along and drives and sets a higher price, the monopoly price. And when that happens, the market clearing price goes away. That the green arrow is no longer the right calculation. You look at where the monopolist intersects with demand, and this is the new monopolist price. And this is how much stuff society gets. And here's the punchline. And I know that this is I'm going to have to, I guess, point out when the punchlines are coming. The punchline is that's how much less stuff society gets. And this is how much more society pays for it. And you can multiply the two of those together, and that's that red area is the value that gets extracted by the monopolist from society. And in fact, economists have a term for it, the monopolist rent. And economists use rent a little bit differently than it's used in normal English. They think of rent in terms of you can invest, you can buy a duplex and get your rents. You can invest in a corrupt government official and in a customs house and you extract rents from that. Or monopolists can invest in acquiring monopoly and extract the monopolist rent. And that is what's wrong with monopolies. Now, I just wanted to start with that little review, because we have a monopoly for a certain type of stuff in our society, and the monopoly gets to supply 95% of it. And it's the nature of a monopoly the whole point of a monopoly is to be able to sell an inferior product for a high price and capture this difference, capture that red air. That's why business people try to get, you know, Adam Smith said you'd never see two businessmen, two capitalists, you know, together that they're not talking about how to fix prices or something. So this is the whole point of having a monopoly, is to basically take that monopolist rent, to take that value from society. Now, we have a monopoly that's supplying some stuff, this monopoly, it controls 95% of the market. It happens to be owned by the government, but that doesn't change this fundamental nature of what a monopoly does. And that is to sell an inferior product at a high price and capture the difference. Now, I'd like to walk through, now here's the simple, that's the most complicated math you're going to see in this presentation. The rest is, I promise, purely fifth grade arithmetic. And for all that we talk about government spending, I'm surprised at how little of the discourse actually contains the data. So I have six very simple points I want to show you. One is, how big are state and local government expenditures? Well, we go to the handy statistical abstract of the U.S., which is, being a citizen and not getting this book is like being a shareholder and not getting the corporate report. It's just a wonderful book that you should, or it's online now, but every citizen should be getting this book. So in a statistical abstract of the U.S., we have, and I'm sorry, for the folks at the table, there's a good monitor down there if you haven't noticed it. I don't want to... Okay. And this is state and local government receipts and expenditures. There's 2007, there's the current expenditures, and there's the number. And it's basically $1.9 trillion. So that's the answer to the first question. $1.9 trillion is how much our state and local governments spend. How big are the deficits? Here's an interesting question. Well, here is the April 2009 state budget update from the National Council of State Legislatures. Now, there's obviously a lot of volatility right now in tax receipts and such, but this is just 6 months old. And here they were saying that the budget gap for this year, well, for the year, fiscal year 2009 ended at the end of June, the high estimate was that it was going to turn out to be $62 billion. So that's another number to plug into the equation. Now, let's do some simple arithmetic. If the deficits are about $60 billion on $1.9 trillion, that's 3.1%. Now, if you're in business, I doubt there's a business person in the room who hasn't at some point had to tighten their belt 3%. It's been certainly, I've done different startups and such, and it's been my unfortunate duty to do that. And usually when I have to do that, I find I go through and I can cut about 20%. But the point is, for all the state and government fiscal crisis we're hearing about, it's 3% of expenditures. That's the deficit as a percent of the total budget. How much do we spend on education in this country? Well, on K through 12 education, we spend, the U.S. Department of Education puts out this book every year, The Condition of Education. And I'm going to show you exactly where you can look this up. If anyone's, I see some people taking notes, you can look these figures up yourself. These are 2005 and 6 are the latest years that they have the data. There's a $250 billion number if you can't see it. And that's about the states spend collectively a little bit over $250 billion. The local spends a little bit under $250 billion. And then there's at the $50 billion is where the federal spending is. So you add this up, $250 billion, $250 billion, $50 billion, that's $550 billion. Here's a more updated, this is more current. This is saying in this fiscal year, education, pre-primary through secondary, it's about $550 billion. But they also have a category, and this site gathers this data from all these different government agencies. And it says, education not definable by level. And there's another $99.8 billion. Now, I'll tell you why that's funny to me. I used to work for Mr. Buffett, and you'll have to forgive me, I end up quoting that guy a lot. And I used to work for him, run a group of companies, and he taught me an income statement shouldn't even have an other line. If it has a line that says other, you're just not managing expenses. So don't have a line that says other. But if you have one, it really shouldn't be more than a percent or two of the whole thing. I don't know what he would say of an other line that was $99.8 billion. Education not definable by level. But if you assume even half of that is going in that to the K through 12, that gets us to the $600 billion number again. So K through 12 education, let's say $600 billion. It's actually, I think I'm going to show you in a minute, it's really probably $650 billion now, but we won't see that for a couple of years. How many students attend K through 12 schools in America, government, public schools, as they're known? Milton, this sounds like terrible name dropping, but of course, not only, I was super fortunate in the last 5 or 6 years of Milton Friedman's life to know Milton and Rose Friedman, and he always insisted that they be called government schools, not public schools, because you know, there are all kinds of private institutions that serve the public. The defining characteristic of the schools is that they're owned by the government. How many students attend K through 12 government schools in the U.S.? And again, we go back to this, and we look at where we are now. The numbers in 2009, or it was a year or two out of date. And there's the total line, and there's where we are now, and it comes to 50 million. Now, there's some punchlines coming, I promise. Thank you for sticking with us. So U.S. public school enrollment is 50 million children. And if we divide one by the other, the $600 billion that we're spending, 50 million children, we get expenditures of $12,000 per child. Now, as I'm going to show you, that's probably a little light. It's probably a little over $13,000 right now. But again, because the data, I'm trying to be a little conservative. We're spending as a country at least 12, and it's probably more like $13,000 or $13,500 per child for every child who attends K through 12 schools. And if that sounds, just to back up this data a bit, here's another table from this book. And you have to dig way to the back of this book. It's funny to me, as I've put together statistics on education, there's all kinds of websites out there with all this information about, you know, or all these arguments about how we're not spending enough on education and how much more we should spend on education and why we should spend on education. But just trying to find out how much are we spending on education and how much per student, and trying to find some of this data, isn't the first thing they throw at you. And there's the table. And this says 11,300, but this was in the year 05-06. And if you even just assume 2 or 3% inflation, that gets you 12,000 now. And the truth is, over the last 20 years, and these expenditures are going up at 5 or 6% a year. And you just do the math again, it comes to, that would suggest it's more like $13,000 or $13,500 per student now in a public school in the U.S. I'm going to show you a seventh of my 6 points, and that is those expenditures are 38% higher than the average of the OECD, and here's the proof of that again. Here's the line right out of, again, it's in the back of the government thing, but that we start spending 38% more than the OECD average. But since that's not, at the moment, really the issue I want to focus on, we're going to take that point away. So, just to hit the highlights, again, we state and local government in the U.S. spends $1.9 trillion. They run a $60 billion deficit, which is 3.1%. This was in April, and of course there was a lot of belt tightening and adjusting. But just to give you a scale, I think it's important people have sort of some sense of what scale these numbers are on. Of that, we're spending, and by the way, of the 1.9 trillion, about 500 billion are transfer payments. So there's about $1.4 trillion that are not, and of that $1.4 trillion, we're spending $650 on education. And which I love, and I'm a public school graduate, and I love education, I love teachers. I've learned that teachers get mad at me because of vouchers, but what I've also learned is that when you show them these numbers, sometimes teachers get mad at the system when they understand what's going on. So that's $600 billion. We're spending educating 50 million kids. It's $12,000, and again, I've baked a little bit of understatement into that. It's probably $13,000 per child. Now let me give you 4 points about public schooling. Expenditure, $12,000 per child, we've just walked through. How many children are in the average government classroom? Here, I love using the NEA's statistics themselves. This is from the teachers' union, and it says 24.6. In the U.S. and D.C. public schools, there's 24.6 children per classroom. So 24.6 children are in the average U.S. classroom. Again, I'm relying on the NEA for that, and you can. But that actually, that's about the center of that. That looks reasonable. Maybe it looks reasonable. From okay, expenditures per classroom then, $12,000 per child times 24.6 children per classroom. That's $295,000 we're spending per public classroom in the United States. Now, if we even use this lower number, and I'm just trying to be a bit conservative, if you even use the 2005-06 number of $11,300 and you do the math, comes to $278,000. And as I've told you, the real number is probably $13,000, and if you do that math, it's like $320,000 we're spending per classroom in K through 12. So just to be on the conservative side, I'm just going to stick in your mind $280,000. It's sort of between these two numbers. It's near the lowest of the calculations, but it's $280,000 to $295,000 to maybe $320,000. Let's just call that $280,000 to be conservative. How much do teachers make? How much does it cost to pay a teacher and to run a classroom? Teacher compensation, and again, I bring this up not because I'm saying that they make too much. I don't think the teachers are paid enough. I'm sure that there are some who are dramatically underpaid. There's probably some who are a little overpaid. But on balance, this is not an argument that teachers are paid too much at all, and I feel I need to say that as soon as you start talking about teacher compensation. This is the U.S. Department of Labor, June 07, what they say, and this is that teachers are paid on average a mean of $47,000. And the NEA itself, I've tried to save on slides, says that there's a 27% benefit load. So now you do the math, and $60,000 is what it costs to pay a teacher's salary and the benefits of being a teacher, you know, the health insurance and retirement and so forth. Now, how much does it cost to run a classroom? The average classroom is a bit under 1,000 square feet in the U.S., but I use 1,000 feet, and those who have been in commercial real estate or real estate know what CAM is, a CAM charge and so forth. I used a very high charge to pick up, which is, this is probably Class A space in Indianapolis would be maybe $20 CAM. That's a very expensive space, but to pay for the heating, the lighting, the cleaning, the classroom, you know, and so forth, and the common space. So there's $20,000. So $60,000, $20,000. It's really about $80,000 of direct costs to have a classroom heated, lighted, air-conditioned, cleaned, and a teacher with full benefits standing there. So teacher compensation and classroom costs, $80,000. Here's the punchline. Here's one of those punchlines I was talking about. If $280,000 of expenditures are going into the system and it's actually costing $80,000 to have a teacher and a classroom, standing in a classroom and to take care of that classroom, the question is, where's the other $200,000 go? I told you there was a punchline. Here would be my first place I would look, that red area. That's the first place I would look to see where what's really going on. Here's a better idea. Let children withdraw from the government schools. Save the $12,000. Now, here, the guild, the monopoly, will interject and say, well, it doesn't save when a child withdraws from a school, it doesn't save us $12,000. Well, that's not what they say when you add a child to the school. They say, oh, it has a, you know, when you withdraw a child, it's, oh, no, all these fixed costs and everything. But if that's, you can't have it both ways. If it's really all fixed costs and stuff and withdrawing one from a school doesn't really save anything, then it doesn't really add anything when you add one. And so that's one answer. The other answer is, again, when I worked for Mr. Buffett, one of the things he taught me was there's really no such thing as a fixed cost. There's a spectrum. And at one end of the spectrum, there are costs that you, if you want to get rid of, you can get rid of in 2 minutes. And at the other end of the spectrum, are costs that will take you, if you want to get rid of, 2 years, maybe 3 years to get rid of. But there's really no such thing as a fixed cost. That was one of his lessons. Well, so in any case, let's say, and besides, the real numbers, like I say, 13,000 or 13,500, and there's 1,000 or two in there of what looks like what they would argue is fixed costs. So let them withdraw, let the anyone who wants to withdraw take a scholarship. I use the word scholarship because the word voucher seems to become so, to antagonize people. Take a scholarship for $6,000. Let the net savings. So the net savings will be the $12,000 that you save minus the $6,000 that they take. So you save $6,000. And again, if somebody says, well, you don't really save the money, well, actually, A, that's not what they say when you add a child. B, there's not a fixed cost. And C, it's probably more like $13,000 anyway. And so let's just assume that there's $1,000 or so stays behind for some fixed costs. Now, here's the fiscal effect. If 20% of children take that deal, if you got offered that deal, I'm just kind of curious, well, I probably shouldn't ask for a public poll, but if I had children, which I don't, which some people say, well, what the heck are you doing making, this fight? As Milton Friedman said, well, would you, if you had cancer, would you only go to a doctor who had cancer himself? Doesn't make any sense. Well, I mean, the numbers add up the same way for me, whether I've had children or don't have children. If I had children, and that would look like a pretty attractive deal to me, to take them, especially depending on where we lived in the country and the state of the government school systems, it sure would look attractive to me, in many cases, to withdraw the child, take the $6,000 and find a private school, the average cost of which is, for K through 8, is $4,200 to $4,800, if it's depending on if it's a religious organization or not, and $5,800 once you're talking about high school. And again, that's if it's non-religious. It's about $5,000 if it is religious. So a $6,000 voucher can get you into an average cost public private school in America. And if you can take the voucher and maybe top it up with $1,000 or $2,000 of your own, which there's all kinds of I'm involved with a scholarship. I've been involved with a scholarship granting organization in Utah where there's a lot of people, low-income people who understand, and the mothers especially seem to really understand this is the issue that matters. If they care about their children, this is the issue that matters. And they're working weekend shifts at the Taco Bell to make enough extra money to be able to top up the scholarship that this private group grants and to get into a $3,000 a year private school. Assume 20% take the deal. Well, remember there are 50 million children in school. 50 million times 20% is 10 million. 10 million take the deal, and you save $6,000 on each. That's 10 million kids, $6,000. That's $60 billion in savings. Now, there's another punchline coming. Does that number, so 20%, if only 20% took the deal, it would save the states $60 billion. And does that number look familiar? That's the deficit. That's the size of the state fiscal deficit. So, and in fact, if 30% take the deal, this is linear, and it's 15 million children, and the states would save $90 billion. So we could wipe out the state fiscal crisis overnight, making a proposal that just 20% of children took. In California, they're seriously discussing letting prisoners out of prison rather than let children out of the failing public schools with a deal like this. Thank you for your attention, and I'd love to take any questions.
Please remember to write down any questions that you have, and staff members will pick them up. I have a couple already. One is, the effort to drive more educational dollars to the classroom has been characterized in recent years by the so-called 65% solution. Can you talk about that effort and what we might see in the future to revisit these efficiency issues?
Okay. Well, besides my involvement with the Friedman Foundation, I was for a while involved with the national movement to guarantee 65% of spending gets spent in the classroom. The national average is 61, and it's dropping about 0.3% a year. At the time I got involved, the national average was 62.5, and there were about four states which were spending over 65% in the classroom. Now, what counts as in the classroom? This isn't my definition. I used because I didn't want that to become part of, you know, the rubber sheet that everybody argued about. There's a congressional definition, and it basically means any time a, you know, a music teacher counts, a football coach counts, any time an adult is standing in front of a child, that counted as classroom. What didn't count was people who were not, that wasn't their main duty. And that's the congressional definition, and they measure it, and there's a published number for every state and every district. And it turns out, of course, I'm sure everybody here has heard, there is no correlation between adding money to the class to the public school system and getting better education. There's no correlation. You can add more and more money and just nothing happens. There is a correlation between the percentage that gets spent in the classroom, and this has been done at the county level, the percentage that gets spent in the classroom and the success of the kids and the NAEP scores of the kids. Now, anytime you have correlation, of course, you don't know if A caused B or B caused A or some other thing caused, you know, C caused A and B. It could well be that in those districts which do meet this standard and where the results are generally better, but it could be that there is a different explanation, which is that there's just some very strong superintendent who is doing the right things both on the spending and making. So you can't know for sure, but what you do know, I think, what we can know is as that number decreases 0.3% a year, just regularly, that can't be good. It can't be good. So I got involved with this movement, and I was originally chair of that organization, to get on the ballots, to get on a referendum around the country, at the state level, a rule that states had to spend 65, that the schools had to spend 65 cents on the dollar. Again, the average was at 62.5 or so when I started. It's dropped to 61. There are some districts where it's under 50. And so that was the principle behind it. That was the thinking. Ultimately, I've become really agnostic about the different proposals people have to fix the government school systems. And I maybe do have my pet theories. I used to teach and know. I think what we really need is a system that lets 100 flowers bloom or maybe 1,000 flowers bloom. And I don't know which ones are going to bloom. And there could be all kinds of different, if you had a real market, which we don't, what we have is a really bifurcated market. There are elite private schools that cost $23,000, and there's other schools, and the vast majority are the lower cost, you know, $5,000-$6,000 or less, and that's how the average gets there. Often they're on some sort of subsidy, effectively, from a religious organization. So what we don't have is a really vibrant market, and if we did, through a voucher or a scholarship granting system, you'd have a real market developed there. So I don't know. I try to stay out of the fights about which is the right way to reform the public school system. And this was maybe an aberration from that principle where I said, well, I would get involved with this just because until we get vouchers or until we get choice in some way, whether it be, you know, charter schools, there's all kinds of choice. There's charter schools, there's tuition tax credits, which you've done in Indiana on a very limited basis. There's vouchers. They're all about choice, giving the parent a choice. Until we do that, I'd get involved with this as a bulwark of further deterioration in the system. But I actually ended my association with that group and have just become completely focused on vouchers because I really don't. I mean, that's a nice stopgap measure, the 65-cent idea. But I think that ultimately it's shining the, you know, it's polishing the teak on the chairs in the Titanic. we can't, the system isn't going to be fixed by trying to reform the government school system until we get some sort of choice. And it may not take everyone defecting. It may take New Zealand. They tried something like this, and about 15% of kids defected from the government school system. The government school system reformed itself, got better, and kids came back. Maybe that's what happens. But until we get some choice, I've sort of given up on other proposals.
Thank you very much. There are a number of questions that address your numbers. So your numbers ignore special ed needs for some students, gym, music, art, and other teachers, school lunch programs, other school facilities such as playgrounds and gyms and office staff and nurses and buses and bus drivers. Do you have numbers that account for these?
And my answer is I didn't ignore them. That is the $200,000. I didn't ignore it. That's where all those numbers are that you just asked about. They're all in that $200,000. And some people might say, does that sound right? If I were a teacher and getting paid $47,000 to stand in front of a class, and I discovered that $60,000 with benefits, and I know the class costs something to have there, and if I were a teacher, and I could see that $80,000 in cost, but I learned that $280,000, maybe $320,000 was coming into the system, and I knew that there was $200,000 to $240,000 going to these other things, I might say that's a little bit out of whack. So I might say it is not the truth that I ignored those numbers. That's in the $200,000. What else is in the $200,000 is whole layers that you and I never see, because they're not in your school system. They're at the district, at the county, and the state. There's all these staff. There's this guild. There's a monopoly that is extracting this red area out of the system. And as they extract it, they don't want that taken away from them. They don't want that taken away, and so their way of dealing with it is when you bring attention to it, they trot the teachers out and they trot the children and they say, oh, don't you care about them? I care a lot about the teachers. I care mostly, or actually overwhelmingly, about the students. I care not much at all about that red area there. And so how much of that $200,000 is a legitimate cost to, you know, bus children to school, to provide them guidance counselors and to provide them other staff within the school to oversee the teachers and to provide staff at the district level to oversee that staff and to provide the staff at the county and the state? How much of that is legitimate? I'm not going to venture an opinion. My guess is members of the Economic Club of Indiana have their own opinions of how much of that's legitimate. But the truth is you're never going to know until you have a market. You're never going to know until you give the parents the choice between choosing between that kind of a system or an alternative which maybe doesn't have which maybe doesn't split the expenditures in the same way. You're never going to expose it until there's some choice.
Thank you. There are a number of questions that relate to capacity in the private system. So how long do you think it would take for the private system to gear up for the influx of students? In other words, is there enough capacity in private schools to absorb 20-30% of the released students?
Not immediately, no. I think that there's about 5% of children in private schools, and they probably could expand to 7 or 8%, you know, within a year. It would take a while for this to spin up. It would take a while for 20% of children to defect. But I firmly believe that if you have this system, if there is this demand, the supply will be created to meet that demand. What I hope is the direction this takes. I love charter schools. Charter schools are a nice step. But I think one way this could go is there could be an industry of very small schools. And any well-educated person you wouldn't put that restriction on it, but parents presumably wouldn't send children to you if you didn't have something to offer. You could open a small, maybe two or three get together and open a small school for two people get together or three and open a small school for 20 children. And maybe it's a math-centric, two very good, maybe something, and with 20 children, with a $6,000 voucher, maybe you top it up $1,000, there's $160,000 of revenue for two people. You could have all kinds of micro schools where if you're a mathematician in industry and you've gotten tired of working in industry, you go into something like this, you can make a good living and you could, you'd have a math-centric high school curriculum. Maybe you'd have a music-centric high school curriculum. Maybe there'd be all kinds of little niches. I would imagine this market would develop is you would end up with some sort of shared facilities that provided some of the services of a school, gym class and things like that, and then neighborhoods or of small academies around it. Something like incidentally happened in Budapest there's this famous high school in Budapest that a bunch of folks went through. It was actually a German school in Budapest, and the neighborhood turned into this neighborhood of tutors, and it ended up turning out Johann von Neumann and Edward Teller and Joshua Barlas, and I forget how many Nobel Prizes came out of this one high school in Budapest. And so, I mean, that's a dream, but I wouldn't be surprised to see the direction the market evolve would be around much smaller scale school education.
Thank you. So now we're going to talk politics.
My least favorite.
Well, we'll insert politics into school here. It seems like a lot of school choice advocates come from the Republican ranks. Are we making progress in getting stronger support from civil rights groups and from Democrats who tend to represent the kids who would benefit most from school choice? How important is that?
That's a great question. I should clarify. I said in one interview recently that I was a Yankee Republican. That was to distinguish myself from I'm a libertarian. I'm not a Republican. I'm actually quite critical of the Republicans, and I go on Fox News and Fox Business and tell them why. But they're very good to me. And I did say in a recent interview, I'm kind of a Yankee Republican, which is very different than the Republican Party is today. And that's this, for example, since you're asking, I believe in freedom, and which means it's like being a left-wing Democrat on social issues and a old Reaganite Republican on fiscal issues. I don't think the Republicans are Republicans anymore on fiscal issues, at least the Republican Party I grew up with, so I don't know where that leaves me. So let's just say, now, it is an interesting fact that this issue has really become a bit of a wedge in the Democratic Party because 67% of African-American families with a child of school-age years and 70% of Hispanic families with a child of school-age years support vouchers. However, normally when it's taught not to discuss politics in a public, it makes people uncomfortable, but I had to ask this question. Should I continue?
You should continue.
Okay. I don't mean to make anyone uncomfortable. The Democratic Party at the national level is very much entwined with the teachers union, with the NEA. Last I checked, about 1 in 5 delegates to the Democratic Convention were NEA members. So the guild, and the guild is the NEA, the teachers union, plus a lot more. So I don't mean to just focus, and I said this on Greg Garrison's show this morning, it's really not just about the union, it's about the whole Educrat system. But there is this issue that is dividing the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party holds itself out. Milton used to say they hold themselves out as the champion of the poor and the disadvantaged. And yet on the single issue that is most important, which is this issue, education for everybody, they're on the wrong side. And there are schools in America where you're more likely to be, in East LA, to be beaten, raped, mugged before you graduate than the chances are that you graduate on time with an average skill set. That's essentially a death sentence. That's a little draconian way to put it, but children who go through that school, all but the rare exception, have very limited life prospects. And to me, And it's another Friedmanism. He says that typically government-provided products do two of three things. They poor in quality, expensive, and they hurt poor people. Education is the trifecta. Education does all three. The government school system, for when you think of what it does for poor people or disadvantaged people, it's poor in quality, it's very expensive, and it hurts them. And there's a great many I have my own theories about why this has been accepted among, why this has been accepted. Well, part of the explanation is, of course, how the Democratic Party is very entwined with the teachers' union. There's other reasons, I think. But there are so many success stories in the African-American community, in the Hispanic community, of voucher programs. And such in D.C., and there's this wonderful woman here, Virginia Walden Ford, who was the hero of the D.C. voucher movement and stood up to Congress and bust hundreds of kids down to get in the face of senators and congresspeople. And Dianne Feinstein cast the deciding vote in that case. And she said, I'm Jewish, but I was poor, and my parents sent me to a Catholic school, and I couldn't live with myself if I voted against it. So they got vouchers 4 or 5 years ago. It was a big surprise. And there's quite, at the political level, for example, there's the Black Caucus of the Florida legislature sort of split with the Democratic Party to some degree and has become a supporter. Rob knows more of the detailed political machinations than I do, and I believe there's somebody here, an African-American man in the state legislature, Representative Taylor, Senator Taylor, did the same thing this year in order to get this very limited tax credit through. So it is turning into a bit of a wedge issue. There's a great deal of support for this in the African-American community. Usually, what I've seen, it's church-based, and I've gone to, liberal academic settings where there's a lot of hostility. I was at one a year ago, and I was making this case, and there's a lot of hostility in an academic university setting. And this fellow I didn't know, guy about my size, but elderly, stood up. He said, basically, I'll take this son, an African-American gentleman. He was a minister, Reggie Williams, minister from, I think, Elizabeth, New Jersey. And he basically stood up and said, how can you look at yourself? You know, how can white liberal America look at itself, understanding what's going on in the inner city schools? That you accept that is just shameful. And to just keep on tinkering, as we have been tinkering as a society for at least my entire life, that I, you know, tinkering with this at the edges rather than saying we can't afford to just waste generation after generation. You know, how can you live with that? So there is this wedge issue between African-Americans and to some degree Hispanic in the Democratic Party and the powers that be in the Democratic Party.
Thank you. We have just a couple of minutes left, so this will be our last question. How do you respond to the arguments that schools cannot be run like businesses and that business leaders ought to stay out of the education arena?
I'd say stop worrying about the system and start worrying about the children.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Patrick Michael Byrne, founder, chairman of the board, and chief executive officer of Overstock.com. Russ Simnick is the president of the Indiana Public Charter Schools Administration. Simnick talks about the basics of public charter school options. He also talks about why kids and their parents might choose a charter school.
Charter schools are tuition-free public schools, and they're opened with this contract that you will be allowed the freedom to innovate, but in return for that innovation, you will be held to the highest levels of academic accountability to perform. So the distinctions between charter schools in that regard would be that they have flexibility. They can make timely decisions and alter their approaches without taking years and years of committees to do that. So they can be very, very nimble in that respect. The core of the charter school movement is really innovation. They have the freedom to innovate, to try new things, to try different approaches, to even tailor those to the students that they have on a very individualized level. Choice. I mean, obviously, charter schools provide choice for parents and kids to come to those to choose why they are to choose the schools for very individualized reasons sometimes. In this country, we have no problem with the concept that you can choose whichever college you want because you specialize in a certain area, be it academics or extracurricular. But in the traditional public school model, it's been more based on your geographic location of your address and not so much of the individualized needs of the students. So charter schools are providing those choices for kids and families. But finally, accountability, that they are accountable to parents who can vote with their feet to leave if the school no longer serves their needs, to their community. They're accountable to the authorizers who actually give them the contract. They have academic and other benchmarks that they must meet, and definitely to the state. As public schools, they're accountable to the State Department of Education on many of the standard things that you would expect in a traditional public. Charter schools are driven by the market and by choice and by parents wanting to enroll their students, and the authorizers look very carefully at what the demand in the community is. If you can't demonstrate that there is a need and a demand for your school in the location that you propose, it'll have a really hard time getting authorized, and frankly, it probably won't. So you have to have that building community demand before you even open. But once you do open your doors, you have to continue to create the reason for parents to enroll their children in your school. So you have to be very responsive to parent needs questions. You'll see a lot of parental involvement in charter schools. You'll see a very individualized approach in many instances to students, and that's one of the things that keeps parents coming back. Statewide, there are nearly 4,000 students on waiting lists for charter schools. Last spring, there was one school in the state, Thea Bowman Leadership Academy, which had 1,000 students on its waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clearly a demand for the current schools and demand for even more schools. In Indianapolis, I believe 1,700 students sitting on waiting list for charter schools. Every charter school is different. Every charter school has a different approach. And you have to look at the schools and really what their mission is, what's their focus. It's really hard to measure really any group of schools with the same metrics, but there have been a lot of attempts to do that. For instance, we have a school in Indianapolis that focuses on treating children in recovery from drug and alcohol abuse. They're going to have really different measures of success than a school, let's say, in Evansville, the signature school, charter school, which has been on the U.S. News and World Report top 100 list of top high schools in the nation. Different population, different needs, different approaches, and different measures of success. But overall, there are certainly some standard ways to do it. Among the students that graduated from mayor-sponsored charter high schools in 2008, 94% are currently enrolled in two or four-year colleges or universities. So graduation rates are really strong, and that's an important measure. Typically, charter school students come in below their peers in traditional schools when they enroll. However, if that is factored out, there was a University of Indianapolis study last year that showed that charter school students experience a significantly more growth in reading, in math, and in language usage. PL 221 is the state's measure of academic success, and last spring, despite making up less than 2% of all public schools in the state, 22% of the top 100 most improved schools in Indiana were public charter schools.
Russ Simnick is the president of the Indiana Public Charter Schools Association. Next month's speaker on the Economic Club of Indiana is Harvard University economics professor Martin Feldstein. Be sure to join us then. Thanks for listening. This has been a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.